Today's UFO Files is an interesting one. It's a great interview with Dr. Alfred Weber up in Vancouver, an expert on exopolitics. And in fact, he talks about some remote viewing with government officials and extraterrestrials, among other things, in this interview. The interesting thing about this interview is we actually recorded it last March 1st. And due to a mix-up, it was lost. But we're lucky now. We found it just in time for the fall season. So let's listen to a very interesting interview with Dr. Alfred Weber. We pick up the show talking about, among other things, the weather. We'll get to some more interesting topics as well, so stick around. So how's the weather up in Vancouver, Alfred?
You know, Jerry, today we have... About 60% of the time it's raining, but today we actually can see some sky. So I think it's generally a pretty good day.
Good. But glad to hear that. You are really one of the, I hate to use the term experts, but I don't know what other word would be better. When we talk about exopolitics, you actually were involved in this originally. First time I heard the term was one time when I introduced or interviewed Dr. Michael Sala, and I know you and Stephen Bassett, with this X conference coming up, have been involved in this for a long time. And I like your website. We're going to talk about that in a moment, and that whole group there, and what you do in Vancouver. But I think as long as we're talking about exopolitics, let's explain to the audience what we're talking about.
Sure. Well, what exopolitics is a framework for approaching what we can call a populated universe. And it's a model for looking at reality. We can say that the 20th century model, via the scientific canon or the kind of the accepted 20th century model, is that all intelligent life ends at the geostationary orbit. And so with the exopolitics model, what we've introduced is a model which says that Earth, in fact, is in a highly populated, organized universe. It's populated with intelligent, sometimes highly evolved civilizations that are organized under some form of governance that are subject to universal law in some form and are mediated by universal politics. And we know this from the simple principles of jurisprudence, for example, and from the principles of the social sciences.
Well, you ought to know that. You're not only just a lawyer, you're a doctorate in jurisprudence.
Yes, right. What we're doing is providing a model for the 21st century, so that as data come in and as new hypotheses come in, for example, Dr. Hal Puthoff's and his colleagues that just came out with their paper in the Journal of the British Interplanetary Society, where they put forth what they call the leaky embargo hypothesis, and that is that this supports, falls exactly within the exopolitics model. What they say is that we live in a highly populated universe, and that the high quality UFO encounters, in fact, are leaked by evolved civilizations, or they are communications to us, deliberate communications, in an otherwise information embargo.
In other words, it's kind of like what goes on in Washington, D.C. all the time.
We may be just at that point in our planetary development, which is very exciting, in which we are coming into an understanding planet-wide in terms of our And in terms of our civilization and our institutions, where not only do we understand and have a public perception that we live in a populated universe, the Broper poll and all the public opinion polls show that, depending on the question that you ask, between 45 and 80% of the respondents say, yeah, we live in a populated universe, and extraterrestrial visit Earth, and all of the above. And so we're now getting to a point where our human institutions, what we call, you know, our governmental forms and legal mechanisms such as treaties, can be employed to integrate ourselves into what the exopolitics model calls universe society.
Yeah, I want to get into your treaties for a peaceful exploration of space and some of that in a little bit. But first, you mentioned extraterrestrials visiting the Earth. Well, you're a Canadian who will be visiting Washington, D.C. for the X Conference. You got a book that's going to come out about the same time. Can you give me a little sneak preview of what that's about?
Sure. You know, this is a book which it's called Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe. And we wrote it, the literary form that we wrote it in is a treatise. Treatises are generally very short. Sigmund Freud wrote his treatise on psychoanalysis, which was a little over 100 pages long, and established that field, put the human subconscious on the map. And what we hope to do is to use the terminology and the models, and using scientifically based methodologies, working with the very fine work of scientists like Dr. Hal Puthoff and also the work of scientific remote viewers, scientists like Dr. Courtney Brown, to demonstrate that we have data derived from the scientific method demonstrate that the universe contains other higher intelligent civilizations other than humans, and that once we get to that, the model which makes the most sense is of things is that we live on a planet which is in the midst of a populated, evolving, organized, interplanetary, intergalactic, multidimensional, because we know about string theory now, universe society. And it's not too much of a stretch to think that there's universal law. I mean, every law student can tell you that the concept of justice, you know, in the abstract, or as a force in nature, under natural law, exists on the Earth. Justice exists on the Moon. Justice exists on Mars. Justice exists in Alpha Centauri. This is a universal principle.
Yeah, we remember in the Supreme Court hearings for Clarence Thomas, he wanted to talk about natural law a lot, or he was asked about it at least. So the term is pretty prevalent in your industry, the legal field.
Yeah, sure. And I think Clarence Thomas, so I have to claim him as one of our own Yale Law School graduates, but we that is a law school that has a very strong tradition in teaching jurisprudence, and we even took courses in Eskimo law and African tribal law to get to the basic principles of what is law. And once you get to those basic principles, you see that these would exist in every society. They would exist in human societies, and they would exist in Martian societies.
Yeah, I know. I just brought Clarence Thomas up as an example. He's far, far from my ideology, but at the same time, the natural law theory really became to the forefront there. And so you're saying that these, for lack of a better term, I guess, rights and wrongs go through the universe.
Yes, justice and universal law exists throughout the universe. And in fact, if we look at the whole theory of if we take this model, the universe as a hologram in which the whole of the universe exists in every part of the universe, that applies also to our governmental forms, because the various governmental forms that have evolved here on Earth, be there aristocracy, monarchy, democracy, kakistocracy is the Greek word for the rule of the worst elements of society.
Thank you for explaining that to me, because that was going to be my next question. We may be in a kakistocracy now.
Actually, it very well may be that these governmental forms that we have here on Earth are replications of governmental forms that exist elsewhere in the universe. If we go to some of the data that were derived in the 1990s, I was at Stanford Research Institute as a futurist back during the Jimmy Carter years, Jimmy Carter being a UFO contactee, self-described UFO contactee. In fact, he filed his own UFO sighting report. At that time, Dr. Hal Puthoff and Russ Targ, colleagues of mine at SRI, were engaged in developing remote viewing. And there were, as a discipline based on scientific protocols, that is, you can replicate results, which is the basic requirement of the scientific method. And advances were built on that throughout the 1980s and the 1990s, to where scientists like Professor Courtney Brown, who writes one of the prefaces in Exopolitics, He is a professor at Emory University, has received awards from the Carter Center in Atlanta, and he developed what's called scientific remote viewing. And based on rigorous scientific protocols with replicable results, and he is able to achieve outside of the time space in what they call subspace, that is where the consciousness of the remote viewer is taken sort of outside of the immediate time space coordinates, and they achieve interactive communication with other consciousnesses through telepathy. And the innovation that Dr. Courtney Brown brought in was to use scientific remote viewing to achieve remote viewing of extraterrestrial civilizations. So he's produced quite a number of data in the form of transcripts, which one can examine all the protocols and the controls in that, and has, in fact, communicated with universe governance authorities of this particular galaxy, for example. So we do have some preliminary data which we as futurists can then use in going about and constructing and verifying the exopolitics model. And that's important because people can say, like, we had this latest Peter Jennings special, and we have an enormous number of UFO sightings, and I first came out in the 1970s with what we call the context communication theory of extraterrestrial communications, and that is that UFO sightings can actually be seen as communications by a higher civilization and have to be interpreted through a series of regular rules in the same way that a psychologist or a psychiatrist can interpret dreams. Of course, according to the theory of dream interpretation. And you can take UFO encounters and interpret them in that same sort with the use of universal symbology as multi-layered communications. Well, we have this whole bank of data of UFO encounters, and the question is, what does it mean? And what the exopolitics model provides is a mechanism by which human society can begin to become self-aware, move away from the 20th century kind of worldview, which is that, hey, there's no other intelligent life in the universe, it's all here on Earth, to a view that we're in a highly populated universe, we're sort of the new kids on the block, and there is a way using scientific remote viewing that we can actually initiate public interest diplomacy with some of the spiritually advanced off-planet cultures that are now visiting Earth. Part of the work that we did in the 1980s was part of the public interest diplomacy movement of Glasnost, during the Glasnost period, when Mikhail Gorbachev was premier of the then Soviet Union. And I produced the Instant of Cooperation, which was the first live radio program ever in history between the United States and the then Soviet Union. It was 4 hours long, and it was carried by NPR satellite in the U.S., and it was carried by Gosselaar Radio in the Soviet Union in all 11 time zones. And we were able, we had citizens on the street in Moscow talking to citizens on the street in Jersey City, and the people in Jersey City were crying because they were sort of, overcoming these artificial barriers which had been created by the Cold War and the permanent war economy, which needed this duality of enemies to keep the economy of permanent war going.
Yeah, I've often thought, and it's kind of off the subject, but communication brought down the Iron Curtain more than anything else. All of a sudden, people could hear and see that those people had the same concerns that we did, and vice versa.
Exactly, Jerry. And we can now, two of the specific programs that we call for in the book Exopolitics is, number one, we call for what's called a decade of contact, and that is that where we have all human institutions, educational institutions, school curricula, governments, community groups are changed and are transformed to acknowledging that we live inside of a populated universe. Human science is devoted to discovering as much as we can about the nature of our populated universe and our position in it. And that bringing ourselves up to that knowledgeable position will create the preconditions for our integration, our formal integration into universe society. The second thing that we call for through what we say is the Star Dreams Initiative, SDI, the opposite of Star Wars.
Yes, right. I like that.
You know, with the Star Dreams Initiative, we call for public interest diplomacy. We have these fantastic techniques, like scientific remote viewing, where there are, we've been given some indication of the nature of spiritually advanced off-planet cultures around Earth. We've been given some indication of from the Galactic Federation and other governance bodies, permission as to which contact would be able to go forward on a government-to-government basis. We need a rejuvenation of the United Nations, kind of bubbling up from the nations and from the grassroots area. We can really make all of this happen. One of the things as a futurist that we've been speaking to people is that we to kind of illustrate the choice, this very critical choice that we as a human society have now. And that is, we say, well, we have, just to kind of boil it down, we have three possible futures, the future A, future B, and future C. And future A we can call the Armageddon future, or the world ends in fire. And that's the future that people are trying to weaponize space, are trying to create, where we will end up exactly going toward Armageddon, toward a nuclear holocaust and nuclear winter. Thank God this past week here in Canada, the government of Canada decided to say no to U.S. missile defense. So we're starting to establish here on this planet sort of areas in which nuclear war cannot go. And future B is, I like to call it, there's that poem, does the world end in fire or does the world end in ice? Future B is the world ends in ice, i.e. it's the global warming future. We're using fossil fuels, it's producing tremendous greenhouse gases. I've spoken to some of the more advanced members of the international panel on climate change. These are 1,000 scientists from 100 countries that use all peer-reviewed science. Some of them, like one of the scientists from Australia, very, very in charge of the institute there at the University of Wellington, he says that human civilization will be extinct by the end of this century based on global warming, because the temperatures, the baseline temperature of the planet is at its warmest in 3.5 million years, and if you add on top of that the fossil fuels, we're going to produce a new ice age. And we have this Pentagon study done by Peter Schwartz, a fellow futurist of mine at SRI, saying that around 2015, the rapid climate change is going to kick in when the Gulf Stream climate systems collapse.
And that's not far away. And one thing, I don't know why we do shows on whether or not there are weather wars or it's Mother Nature or whatever, but one thing for sure, this year alone, ask any TV meteorologist, those weather models aren't working.
Exactly, and there, it may be that there are parties on the planet that are engaging in very dangerous environmental warfare. And there's some evidence that the recent tsunami may have been triggered by neutron bombs and or other mechanisms. And there's some evidence that, as you know, scalar weapons and or other weapons have been used either as seismic weapons to create the December 26, 2003,
yes,
in BAM, Iran, et cetera, et cetera. So those are the two futures.
Surely there's something hopeful.
The SEE future is the exopolitical future. And that is where we, as a civilization, reach out to our exopolitical neighbors who have developed free energy, who have transformed, you know, who have gotten beyond war. We take and we ban weapons in space, which is we do not allow the permanent war economy to expand into space, and we transform the entire aerospace industry instead of into a war industry.
I understand what you're saying, but I must say, things coming out of the Pentagon here in the United States are not very encouraging. They're declaring the area between the moon and here, near space, United States territory.
Right. That's the doctrine of space denial. And if one goes to the internet, you can find the vision for 2020, which was the strategic vision of the U.S. Space Command, which essentially is to seize the military high ground of space, and from that military high ground, as you stated, through the doctrine of space denial, to control Earth from space through either space-based platforms and other weapons, and space from space by controlling the egress and access to the Earth, and thereby controlling the resources of the celestial bodies and of all the solar system. Now, this is where the vision of the permanent warfare economy comes up and into the demands of, or the requirements of, galactic citizenship, and kind of the limitations and the desire that if this planet is to go out into space, it be so as a peaceful member of universe society, not as a warring member.
Now your organization up there has been making overtures or plans, research, studies with nations about this. I imagine how do we stand? I don't think the United States is for it. I mean, the present administration.
Jerry, yes and no.
Okay.
We're in about a 20-year process now, and this is a real struggle. It's a day-to-day struggle, and the jury's still out. But we are, more and more of the American population and of the world population is waking up to the fact that we are a paradise planet, that we are one human family, that there is no reason to weaponize space because there is a peaceful universe society that wants us to join, and that we do have a choice, which is at sea, which is that the exopolitical future. Now, let me give you a concept of how it is that we're making inroads even against the $1 trillion military budget.
Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, this is the $1 trillion and the visioning of the same folks who brought you Vietnam and the same folks who brought you Iraq, i.e. war doesn't work. We have to move to advanced forms of nonviolent conflict resolution. We cannot do it through war. And this is how far we've gotten. From 1972, when Nixon and Brezhnev, who were two hawks, introduced the ABM treaty, until June 13, 2002, when the Bush administration unilaterally abrogated the ABM treaty, ballistic missile defense systems were banned, because it was seen that they were actually in implementation of a nuclear first strike. They're actually first strike enhancement weapons, because what a ballistic missile defense system, and this was extensively war game during the Reagan administration, when the predominant thought during the Reagan administration was that nuclear wars are winnable.
Yeah, and these guys scare the hell out of me talking about nuclear war like that.
Whether one can co-opt the world into believing that we have a worldwide nuclear war in our future. You know, were there weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? Well, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me, right?
And I agree with you, but it looks like they're going with the same program again.
If we allow them to go forward with that, shame on me.
Yeah.
Because we know what they're up to. So What we're doing from a counter strategy, and what I say we is a movement that includes not only the peace movement but worldwide. I mean, every year the UN General Assembly holds a vote on whether they want a treaty permanently banning all weapons in space. And at the last vote, the one in on December 8, 2003, the vote was 174-0 in favor of the treaty banning all weapons in space.
So even the United States went along with that.
Well, there were three abstentions: United States, Israel, and Micronesia.
Micronesia, that's strange.
I think they're like a nuclear client of the U.S. because that's where all the hydrogen bomb tests were. So, but we have the votes. So what we're doing now is we're saying, okay, you want to play power politics? We'll play people power politics. And what we were able to do here in Canada, starting in 2001, and here in Vancouver, it started off at a church meeting at the Unitarian Church. I remember went down and spoke there, and 10 people came up and wrote letters to the Prime Minister of Canada after that, and the Foreign Minister of Canada, and said, you know, do not join U.S. missile defense. It's the first step in weaponizing space. We want a treaty conference to ban weapons in space. Well, lo and behold, it's taken us 3 or 4 years, and this has caused quite a reverberation because the forces that are trying to weaponize space, they were counting on Canada for their political cover. So it's like we're the world's second largest landmass. The world's first largest landmass is Russia that covers 11 time zones. Well, we're the world's second largest landmass. And they were counting on putting installations up in the Arctic Circle for attacks on Russia in northern Canada. Well, guess what? About 3 days ago, the talks between the Pentagon and Canada to put sensors for the ABM systems for the missile defense systems were canceled. So we're starting to make inroads, and that's just when folks go to meetings, who write letters. We had a federal election last June. All, you know, everybody, we all went down. We went to election meetings. We handed out pamphlets. We talked. We did this, that, and the other thing. And we came up with what's called a minority government, i.e., nobody has a majority in parliament. And that was the first time in 25 years that the Liberals went back down to a majority from a majority government. And it was all on missile defense because we were able to bring. And if you look at the public opinion polls right now in the United States, they're amazing. They're identical to those in Canada. Only 26% of the American public supports a missile defense system, number one. Number two, this is the Pew Endowment, which is a very, very high-quality poll.
Yes, it is.
High-integrity poll. Fully 74% of the American public believes that a treaty banning all weapons in space, quote, is a good idea. Those are almost identically the mirror images of the public opinions in Canada. So we were able to take the same public opinion, put it into the political system and get a ban. And I believe that the same sort, we've got the same exact mirror image because North Americans really share the same values no matter how much they want to separate us. And I believe it's just a matter now of working the politics. So we're launching now. See, our purpose is to bring exopolitics into the mainstream so we're no longer inside at the margins. And that's why at the Exopolitics Conference in Washington, D.C., the plans had not been finalized, but I received an email from the communication last night from the organizer.
Yeah, we talked about that before the show, and Stephen was able to get something in the National Press Club before, so hopefully it'll happen this time. In fact, I'm going to play that soundbite. We recorded you when you were talking about that, and we'll edit that in the show, so you won't have to go through it again here, so the listener knows what we're talking about.
Last night, from the organizer, Steve Bassett, and he's thinking about, he said he's about 90% sure that he's hoping to have a press conference there just prior to the X conference at the National Press Club. with Dr. Michael Sala, Richard Dolan, and myself, with Steve moderating, to begin to raise the profile, the public profile of exopolitics to the Washington Press Corps. I was part of the whole disclosure project. You know, the press conference was down there in May, in the May of 2001, and I was a disclosure project witness. I couldn't travel at that time, but I served as the U.S. congressional liaison, and also as one of the press people. I did all via phone here. So if this happens, you know, we might be able to, in the aftermath of the Peter Jennings special, however, you know, which people are commenting on now, we might be able to bring exopolitics as a discipline into the mainstream.
That sounds pretty exciting.
And you know, what is your appraisal of Peter Jennings on the UFO question?
On the UFO issue, I invite readers to go to our exopolitical comment thing called exopolitics.com. We have a long article there that summarizes all of the comments that have been garnered.
What is your opinion? I thought it was kind of a mixed bag, but at the same time, can Peter Jennings be co-opted by the government?
Here is what I wrote, okay?
Okay.
I'm reading from exopolitics.com. I personally found it very hopeful that on February 24, 2005, The very same day, one, that Prime Minister Paul Martin announced that Canada would not participate in the development of the U.S. missile defense, and that, two, ABC held its celebrated infamous special on UFOs, we were able to break through as a mainstream futurist interviewed on CFRA, the Prime Chum Network. My vision and affirmation is that Earth is being peacefully integrated into a larger organized universe society. In the same way that we have been able to transform a Prime Minister Paul Martin, who on April 27, 2003, called for Canada to join U.S. missile defense, so we will be able to transform a human governmental structure that is now divided and confused about integrating with the universe society to do so. Properly understood, exopolitics provides us with a framework for integrating with a living, receptive universe society. Remember, more people believe that extraterrestrials visit Earth than vote in disputed UX political elections.
That's a good point.
Yeah, we are an exopolitical planet now, if you just take the attitudes of the preponderant majority of the human race. And all that we have to do is give ourselves the kind of the structural and institutional mechanisms by which to put these values and attitudes into play.
Now you're pushing something called the U.S. Space Preservation Act. What's that all about?
What it is that we have proposed a space preservation treaty, and that treaty is a United Nations treaty which builds on the 1967 UN Outer Space Treaty, which banned weapons of mass destruction in outer space, which 119 countries have signed. Which bans all weapons in space, including the scalar weapons, the directed energy weapons, the mind control weapons, all of that, and keeps them out of outer space. So outer space is a universe commons and a weapons-free space. And what we're doing is we're working with inside the United Nations. We're working with the lead nations like Russia and China, who have brought a similar proposal. We're working directly with China, with Canada. We're now working directly with Dr. Keith Martin, Member of Parliament, who's the second Minister in Command of the Department of Defense, of the Ministry of Defense here in Canada, to bring the Space Preservation Treaty in a special treaty conference of the United Nations. Canada, in 1997, held the Landmines Treaty Conference, and what happens is where you have a special class of weapons that are particularly dangerous, like back then it was the landmines that were blowing up kids' limbs and everything.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, exactly. They brought together 123 nations over a three-day period to Ottawa. Princess Diana got involved, and they signed the Landmines Treaty, and even though the U.S. hasn't been a signatory, the U.S. is behaving as though that's international law. So it's been a success. And so what we're saying is that let's have a space preservation treaty. And we've had a bill in the Congress since the year 2001, the Space Preservation Act, which is the U.S. version, which would have the U.S. president enter into a space preservation treaty. We've had over 274 U.S. and international non-governmental organizations sign on to the Space Preservation Act and endorse it. And people who want to sign a United Nations petition, online petition, which thousands of people have signed, to the President of the General Assembly to hold this Space Preservation Treaty, can go to our campaign website, which is www.peaceinspace.org. And so we have a broad non-governmental organization base. We have a concrete proposal, which is that the City of Vancouver, British Columbia, has proposed to hold the World Peace Forum in June of 2006, and we said, well, why not hold a space treaty conference here as part of it? It doesn't have to be here. But at least now that we've gotten past the first major hurdle with the government of Canada.
Yeah, I take it you're pretty encouraged.
Yeah, you know, I'm saying, see, I'm not frightened of these guys. George Bush and I were at Yale at the same time. John Kerry and I were in the political union at Yale. They're just guys. And they have limited frameworks. They have certain interests. They haven't been exposed to the same information that we in our community have been exposed to. They might have certain values. It turns out, I think, that the crucial factor at this time, it's almost as though we have the battle of the worldviews, and the crucial task right now is education, bringing our worldview into the mainstream arena in a way that's non-threatening, but everybody can get on board, because our joining universe society should not be threatening to anybody. It should be a joyful act, even to the owners of the fossil fuel economy, because let Esso and let all the Rockefeller oil people, hey, they've had their profits for 150 years. Let them get into new energy. Big deal.
You know, I want to talk to you a little bit about the Institute for Corporation in Space. How long have you had that?
This is a very interesting enterprise. Dr. Cal Rodson, who is down in our South America headquarters, which is in Vilcabamba, Ecuador, where she is the president of the Institute. It's a 501c3 nonprofit. And Dr. Cal Rodson is down there, and also our director of new energy, the astronaut, Dr. Brian O'Leary, is down there. And we have our North American headquarters in Vancouver, B.C. It was founded, Dr. Rodson and myself, and the honorary chairman of our board, Sir Arthur Clarke.
Oh, yeah, right. I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, and he's written, Childhood's End and all these prophetic books, as well as being the inventor of the telecommunications satellite and has written 60 scientific books. We all met at the 1983 United Nations Outer Space Conference in Vienna, Austria. And this was right before the whole Star Wars initiative of the Reagan administration came in. And so at that point, the Institute, the predecessor in the Institute for Cooperation in Space, called the Institute for Security and Cooperation in Outer Space, was born. And Carol Rosen was credited with being the political architect of the strategy that successfully defeated Star Wars during the Reagan administration and kept outer space from being weaponized. Then we came together again in the summer of 2001 when we saw the news that the Bush administration was threatening at that point, which is still done, has since done, to abrogate an anti-ballistic missile treaty. Now, it turned out coincidentally that we came together in March of 2001 where both Dr. Carol Rosen and myself and other people like Leslie Kane and Danny Sheehan, who's Leslie Kane is...
Oh, I know Leslie Kane. I'm a big fan of hers.
Yeah. Yeah, well, she's since moved to New York.
Yeah, has she?
And Leslie is one of the Institute for Cooperation in Space's UFO advisors. Danny Sheehan is the general counsel of the Institute for Cooperation in Space. And we came back then together again after being formed back in 1982. We came back together because we were brought together as all witnesses by Dr. Stephen Greer in the Disclosure Project. And we helped Stephen, along with Steve Bassett, in a behind-the-scenes effort to pull together the congressional connections through Dennis Kucinich, to pull together the press connections. So it was covered by the World Press. Carol and Danny flew in for the press conference. I was going to come in, but I couldn't travel at that point.
Didn't you do something by phone?
Yeah. I did a lot of stuff via phone, and that was when we first hooked up with Dennis Kucinich, and then we actually drafted the Space Preservation Act, and he introduced it as H.R. 2977. He did that in October of 2001 when he couldn't get into his offices because it was closed down because of anthrax that turned out came from the CIA anthrax facility at Fort Detrick. So he played an heroic role at that point. One has to give Dennis Kucinich credit. And those were the days where he came and gave the Prayer for America speech in the Florida House of Congress. Congress couldn't even get into its offices in October 2001, and Kucinich went and introduced the Space Preservation Act at those days. So, we've been through some moments. We have turned the corner here up in Canada. We're looking for the reintroduction of the Space Preservation Act into the U.S. Congress. We're working very closely with the Hispanic Caucus, of the House of Representatives. The Hispanic Caucus, you may recall, voted 15-0 against the War in Iraq resolution because the Hispanic culture, including Mexico is a pacifist country. They're a non-nuclear power. They will not allow nuclear weapons on their soil, and they will not join in the war on
terrorism. By the way, before we let you, our time's almost up here. It's been a fast hour. It's been riveting all along. But, talking about the Disclosure Project in the United States, what do you think the chances are? It seems to me your country, Canada, is much more open. You've been much more successful in putting pressure. You think you can get some disclosures coming out of Canada, or is there anything there to disclose?
Well, this is what we're kind of focusing on, is that we really believe that at this stage, things are going to go into a rapid a period of rapid acceleration in terms of the general openness of society to these concepts. We're going to be doing we're going to be doing a lot of outreach. Now that we have the exopolitics model, which is a way that then governments can rationally approach, because you can say, okay, well, we want a democratic relationship with universe society. We don't want to cede our human sovereignty. We want to have the rights and responsibilities that come out of treaty relationships. We can satisfy a lot of the concerns that have been raised by a lot of the thinkers over the last 50 to 75 years who have been dealing with the whole issue of contact. I think that by working here in Canada, by outreaching in the United States, which is the country that has had the most UFO encounters, which has a highly vibrant population, that 2005 and 2006, it's not so much disclosure as it is awareness and education, i.e., I believe that we're moving away from a model of disclosure to a model of education, acceptance, and exopolitical integration. It's much more functional.
Well, I want to ask you, as a Canadian, about Peter Jennings one more time. I think in my personal impression was that the show actually kind of opens the door to discussion and awareness here in the United States and in North America, period. And Peter Jennings, an intelligent fellow, if he was going to try to shut it down, it didn't appear that he really tried, even though he did say there's no such thing as Roswell, did say there was a myth. He did make, there was a lot of negativity in the abduction stories, but overall, I thought it really went toward maybe a little more awareness of the general public about UFOs. And I just wonder what his angle was.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And another observer who has very similar opinions to what you just stated, which I share also, found that the interview that he held the night before...
Yes, sir, we talked about that, and they asked him what he thought about it, and he says, well, the question is, they're out there, but who's flying them?
Right, and he read an email from his son, and which was sort of, we may not have gone to the whole truth on the Kennedy assassination, but there, if you'd reveal the whole truth there, there were so many crimes, may have been so many crimes committed there that by revealing those crimes, the criminals are going to have to commit more crimes to cover up their old crimes. Whereas I believe that the country that really has a lot of wisdom is South Africa, where they didn't go into a reprisal kind of mentality for the crimes that had been committed against their society.
We have lots of listeners in South Africa, and they I find it always pretty interesting. There is some of this segregationist attitude still, but at the same time, they tolerate things, and certainly it's a textbook case of how to open up a society without vindictiveness.
Exactly, because they have these reconciliation process and reconciliation tribunals where people just had to come and tell the truth, and there were no sanctions. And there have been so many crimes committed, either through the various assassinations or through the UFO cover-up, over the years, that maybe a strategic way, which Peter Jennings was reading an email which his son sent him. His son is, you know, probably a typical person trying to get his dad to open up, saying, "Dad, and Peter Jennings was saying, "Well, maybe what I'm actually doing here is I'm getting to cover the biggest story ever." Now, he did two things. Number one, three things actually. Number one, he established a valid database for the universe being populated and us being visited now. And number two, he didn't expose the crimes of Roswell and the entire cover-up of Roswell, which if he would have done, there would have been a lot of people that would really have gotten nervous. And number three, he stayed away from the abduction issue, which a lot of people are very confused about right now, because it goes into...
Well, yeah, there's a lot of questions here.
Yeah, and it goes into genetic programs that have been approved by other levels of authority, or may have been approved by other levels of universe authority, which we humans don't quite understand yet, okay? And where mistakes may have been made. So while I'm not trying to excuse that program, but I'm trying to, as I think you did, to frame it in terms of a gradual process.
No, I tell you this much, he gets unbelievable pressure for doing shows like that. We do, and we do, when we first started doing UFO shows, you'd be amazed. And one of the things about I noticed in the United States was this program didn't have a lot of commercials that were paying prime rates. They were things that do what you call a yearly bulk buys, and they throw the spots in when they don't have anything sold. And I know that for a fact because I deal in that business. And so ABC financially didn't make any money there. They might have got a good rating, but they didn't. Yeah, they were in the toilet on Thursdays anyway, so whatever they got would have been an improvement.
I believe that the linkage effects or the aftermath of this program, it makes it safer now for people to continue their research. It makes it safer now for broadcasters to go in there. It makes it safer now for the exopolitical process to roll out.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I know for one thing, it certainly improved our hits right on our website. And our time's up. We could go on forever. We look forward to the book. We look forward to that appearance at the National Press Club. I hope it comes off. And good luck in Washington at the X Conference, and we'll stay in touch.